This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Futuro.
I never thought of staying. I never thought that this was what I wanted. But MIT is really, honestly, a very special place. And I've been here for 40 years for that reason.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a conversation with Venezuelan-born Rafael Reif, whose tenure as president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is coming to a close. For over 10 years, Rafael Reif has been the only Latino president of a top U.S. university. In fact, the school he leads, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, widely known simply as MIT, is ranked number 2, only behind Princeton. Reif's journey to MIT's helm is a long and unexpected one. His Jewish parents, born in Eastern Europe, fled the continent during Hitler's rise and increasing anti-Semitism in the late 1930s. They escaped to South America, eventually settling as refugees in Venezuela, where Reif was born. After studying electrical engineering, he applied to Stanford University in California for his doctorate, which he got in 1979. After achieving far more than his parents, who were denied these opportunities by their challenging circumstances, Reif was ready to return home to Venezuela. But something would change his plans and his future. MIT invited him for an interview. It would be the beginning of an engagement that would last over 40 years. Reif is an immigrant by choice, unlike many in his home country of Venezuela who have been forced to flee, just as Reif's parents once did too. This year alone, more than 150,000 Venezuelan migrants and refugees have arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Venezuelans now account for roughly half of all migrants traveling through Latin America, and more than 7 million are estimated to be living as migrants and refugees.
Reif's own family history and the harsh reality of his countrymen and countrywomen have made him a vocal supporter of immigrants, particularly of those who, like him, have sought to continue their education in the U.S. When Donald Trump imposed an anti-immigrant travel ban in 2017, Reif spoke up against it.
We will not be able to compete globally, particularly not be able to compete with a worthy opponent, a competitor as China, if we don't have the help from talent from all over the world.
And when the former president tried to deport international students amid the COVID-19 pandemic, MIT, under Reif's leadership, joined Harvard in a lawsuit against ICE and the Department of Homeland Security. As president of MIT, Reif can look back with pride at his push to invest in innovation. Under his watch, MIT created a new business incubator to advance scientific and technological change.
So here is the idea. Today, as you just saw, MIT is launching a separate entity called The Engine. The Engine will support tough tech firms working on big societal problems.
But he also had to lead the university through many challenges, from the coronavirus pandemic.
El mundo ha cambiado, las universidades han cambiado, Y tenemos que reconocerlo y estamos en medio de ese cambio en estos momentos.
To sexual assault on campus.
The most important work is up to all of us. We need to actively build a culture that treats sexual harassment, coercion, and assault as out of bounds, unthinkable for anyone of any age, in any context.
Earlier this year, Rife announced his decision to leave MIT's leadership. His departure would only reduce diversity in all levels of higher education. There will no longer be a Latino at the helm of a top school in the U.S. This comes at a time when government data shows that Black and Latino and Latina students are less represented in elite schools today than they were decades ago. And the Supreme Court could soon decide to end affirmative action policies, precedent established over 40 years ago with the intent of promoting diversity and racial integration. Today in our conversation with Rafael Rife, we look at how his immigrant background shaped his career and what his message is for Latina and Latino students who want to pursue higher education. Before we start, I'd like to know how I should address you. Like, you know, President, Leo, Rafael, what do you prefer?
Well, Maria, if you allow me to call you Maria, I would love it if you were to call me Rafael. That's my name.
So Rafael, officially welcome to Latino okay. USA.
Muchísimas gracias.
And tell me, why is it important for you, someone who holds this position of the president of MIT, why is it important for you to just be like, hey, no. I like people to call me Rafael.
Well, it matters to me because I like to treat everybody with respect and I like to treat everybody like we're equal. And if I have a title and I insist that others call me by that title, that means me putting some distance between me and another person. And I don't like to do that.
Rafael, I'm meeting you for the first time now. But this notion of kind of el respeto mutuo, o sea, for humanity, I see the human in you. And from the get-go, there is mutual respect. So talk to me about why this notion of mutual respect is so deeply important to you.
Well, it is to me very emotional. It's very personal. And has been like that all my life, and I don't see that ever changing. It's very much part of who I am. And I think I come from a very humble, modest family with very little material resources. And I remember as a little boy, my father doing everything he could to support the family, like many fathers and mothers do today. And I remember with pain seeing people basically humiliating him and not giving him any respect because he was doing menial jobs while everybody else was doing more important stuff. And I remember one day him coming home and, you know, he had a very good day because somebody smiled at him and is supposed to humiliate him. So,
my God. Oh, my God. Perdón que te interrumpo y ya te tuteo aparte. But, like, oh, my God. Like, your dad came home happy? Because someone had smiled at him?
Correct.
I mean, how old were you when that happened?
Oh, I was just a little kid. I mean, 4 or 5 years old. I mean, those things. Look, he was a decent man. He was a very smart man, but he did not have the opportunity of having an education. So is that the difference? Why would somebody treat him in a disrespectful way? Because he didn't have the opportunity that other people have had. So that's why, to me, I mean, each time, to this day, when I see somebody doing a menial job, I want him to be recognized. I want everybody to be seen by me. I want them to be noticed and for them to know that I notice them. Because everybody is important to me. Every human being is important to me. It doesn't matter whether they have a title or not, or they have a lot of money or not. This is just a way for me to make sure that everybody see me as an equal, because I'm equal to everybody else, for all human beings.
So, Rafael, I'm not seeing you. You turned your camera off, but I have to ask you, were you just getting really emotional? I mean, you were crying, am I right?
Well, yeah.
Tell me what you're feeling.
Well, it's just the connection with my family, my parents is very deep for me.
Because, I mean, I'm not asking more because now you've got me crying and I'm just like, I'm like, okay, hold on a second. I'm having an interview with the president of MIT and within the first 5 minutes, we're both in tears. What just happened here?
Because you made me talk about my dad, Maria. This is all your fault.
Well, so tell me, I'm sorry, perdón, but you know, dads are great. Look, you're making me cry.
Well, Maria, nobody's going to pay attention to us if we keep crying here.
So what you don't know, of course, is that my dad was a nerd like you. Mi papá ayudó a construir, a crear the cochlear implant. He was a genius. He was based at the University of Chicago, medical doctor, researcher. So when you're like crying about your dad, I'm like, no, it's because like I'm doing this because of my dad. But he did get the opportunity. His dad did not. So I get to ask the question because actually your dad like has this very particular experience. And I think that's another reason why it's like it's emotional because your family actually had to flee Eastern Europe in the late 1930s. Your family was being persecuted. Your family found their way to Venezuela. That's where you were born and raised. So can you talk to me a little bit about your dad? ¿Se consideraba, era refugiado? ¿Ustedes se identificaban como refugiados? Did he identify as a refugee family? Was that part of your identity? Is that why this is partly so emotional too?
No, not really. I wouldn't say that. I think I use the word refugee simply because there is so much of that these days, unfortunately, in the world, and people escaping for different reasons. From my home country, Venezuela, there are many people leaving the country for all sorts of reasons. So as a kid, I remember that we didn't have much of anything, and we live in a poor neighborhood. But as a kid, you just don't know. You assume everybody's the same. I don't think that I had the image or the upbringing of a refugee. We were very poor. Yes, we didn't have what other people had that we can kind of see. But it was not part of my identity. It's just simply seeing this couple who left Europe and there are so many difficult circumstances. All my family, my father's side, were basically, you know, died during the Holocaust. Mm. So, I mean, just the memory of these two individuals trying to provide for I'm the fourth of four kids, the struggle they went through. Again, I go back to the mutual respect. It's all about respecting human beings. It's not that I feel like I was a refugee. I didn't feel any of that. My parents never spoke about what they went through. I knew about it, but they wouldn't talk about it.
When I hear you talking about this, I'm like, oh my God, they're part of this historical moment, like a worldwide moment. And yet they made a choice to not talk about that with you. What do you think about that?
All I can do, Marie, is speculate, right? I assume that they did not want. I was brought up without any sense of anger or hatred. I never heard anything that has to do with you know, this society or these people did this to me. So I think in a way it's about not to bring kids up with a sense of, you know, of betrayal or with a sense of people are not good. And I also think that perhaps my father may have had a sense of guilt because he was the only one. He escaped before the whole family was taken to a ghetto and then to a concentration camp. And I think probably he had felt the sense of guilt.
Mm. So this movement from one place to another actually becomes part of your life too. I mean, I imagine that at some point you just thought, no, pues me quedo en Venezuela and I'll stay in Venezuela. But in fact, you were hungry. And yes, I'm sorry, a nerd. So you end up studying electrical engineering at, of all places, Stanford University. So you yourself, Rafael, end up then experiencing a country as an immigrant. And I wonder, how do you think, you know, your process of leaving Venezuela, coming to the United States, now becoming part of the Latino diaspora in the United States, how do you think that your own story, not your parents' story, your grandparents', but your own story has impacted you and shaped you and your work?
I'll have to reflect on that, Maria. You know, I did not escape to come to the United States. My situation was much more different than my parents'. And I studied electrical engineering, Maria. I apologize to disappoint you, but not so much because I was a nerd. Although I think I'm a little nerd. But I really studied engineering in Venezuela because I needed a job. I mean, I was lucky that I went to university. Lucky because many people without resources just have to get to work. And my two oldest brothers, in fact, they didn't go to high school after elementary school. They were to help my father just make a living. So I was lucky that I went to college. So I had to figure out, okay, I have to get a job. And I looked around and it was very clear that the country, Venezuela, at the time needed lots of engineers, most of them electrical engineers. So bingo, that's my career. So I had to choose something that I can secure to get a job, because otherwise, who's going to help me and give me some food? Eventually, I did go to Stanford and I was lucky enough to be able to get there. But mostly because I realized after I got my degree of engineering and I went to work for a company for a little while, I realized that working, maintaining equipment and stuff like that was not my thing. And I was very lucky to have a position as an instructor at a university in Venezuela, La Simón Bolívar in Caracas. And I realized that I love being with students. I love being with people who are intellectually curious, who ask questions, who just, the intellectual environment of a university was fascinating to me. And I realized, well, you know, that's what I want to be. I want to be a college professor. But again, you don't just get jobs because you want them. Even if you compete for them, you have to know somebody. And I didn't know anybody. I was just a nobody. But I figured, well, if I get a PhD, I'll have a very good chance of keeping this job that I just got, just retaining it. So I went to get a PhD and to come back. I did not leave the country to be an immigrant. I left to get a PhD and to come back to that job in that university. That was my aspiration at the time.
Coming up on Latino USA, MIT President Rafael Reif on today's Venezuelan Refugees, on the importance of Latino and Latina representation in higher education, and how he sees his tenure as he gets ready to step down. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. We're going to continue our conversation with Rafael Reif in his last weeks as president of MIT. I'm thinking about what we in the United States have witnessed, human beings being trafficked by members of the government. So Florida Governor Ron DeSantis transported migrants from Texas to Massachusetts, your state. And many of them were Venezolanos, Venezuelan, just like you.
The 48 asylum seekers, mainly from Venezuela, landed in Martha's Vineyard aboard two planes from Texas and organized by Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. Luis Fonseca says he left Venezuela to look for a better life for his three children who are still there.
And so I'm wondering how you've been processing not only Venezuela, but the fact that there are so many Venezolanos now who are refugees in the United States and their treatment by elected officials in this country.
Well, it's extremely sad. This whole situation has been extremely painful to me for years already. I remember until a few years ago following the situation in Venezuela very closely. In one moment, I remember reading something in the paper about the story of how people were escaping and all the things they were doing in other countries to leave, because they had no other way to get jobs and stuff. The neighboring countries could not absorb the migration of Venezuelans. And I remember it just really tore my heart apart. I mean, it just was very painful. And I mean, I just had to stop reading, had to stop becoming aware, because I couldn't deal with that anymore. I remember I was on a business trip. I happened to be in Ecuador and in Quito. And I remember arriving at the hotel from the airport in the evening, and I heard Venezuelan music coming into the window. And I looked out and I looked a few people, you know, playing with typical Venezuelan instruments. And I said, what's going on here? This is years ago. So I quickly went downstairs to find out who they were. And they told me, well, they just were migrants. They were lucky to have those instruments. That's what they're doing, living in the street to try to make a living. Mm. I mean, that's just too painful. Now we have migrants here in the United States being moved for political reasons. Mm-hmm. It just makes you feel terrible about the human condition and how, again, as I said before, what humans do to each other. It's just much too painful.
It's very interesting, Rafael, because people say to me, oh, Maria, you know, you're obsessed with the issue of refugees and migrants and immigrants because you are an immigrant. And it's like, no, I'm actually obsessed with this country's capacity for inhumanity towards people who simply were not born in this country. You're clearly a deeply emotional person. How have you been managing your emotions?
Well, as I said, Maria, it's hard. I think I tried to protect myself a little bit, as I couldn't do when you start asking those tough questions about my parents.
Sorry.
I have a job to do, and I try to live my life every day and to convey to everybody around me the dignity and almost the sacred way of treating each other with respect. And that's really all I can do. There is nothing that I can do to change the situation, whether it's right now in America with Venezuelans or whether, quite frankly, Maria is all over the world. So sometimes it feels pretty hopeless, of course. And there are many human beings who do very many good things. And I want just to connect with them and do things with them and try to work with them. I try to do productive things that compensate for what others do that are so damaging to the human condition.
Mm. Well, you are in a position to have influence. And I'm wondering about that journey, because again, you know, you were like, look, I'm going to become an electrical engineer because there's a need for electrical engineers in Caracas, which is a booming capital at that point. And then all of a sudden your journey leads you to being the only Latino of a top university in the United States. So what was that journey like and how did you get there?
Well, that's a long story. We need a whole day for me to tell you the story. But,
the short version.
Okay, short version. Let me give you the quick summary. Well, I get my PhD and then to my pleasant surprise, I was asked by Stanford to stay there in some capacity to work there, to do some research there. And I hesitated because I did want to go back home to Venezuela, but also to my family and friends. But I figured, again, thinking about my career, if I have a PhD from Stanford, and on top of that, I can say I also worked at Stanford, that will embellish my curriculum even more. And I can really secure a job where I wanted as a teacher at a university. So that's what I did. And I told them that I will only do it for a year and a half, not more than that. And that's exactly what I did. As I was literally packing my bags and going back to Venezuela, then MIT approached me and they wanted me to come to a conversation, an interview. And I was very uninterested in doing that because Stanford is one of the best places in America. So if I'm leaving Stanford, why do I go to MIT? What's the point? But to make a long story short, they insisted very strongly. So I figured, let me just go. I want a career in academia, so I want people at MIT to think highly of me. So I figured, well, I'll go and visit just to get them off my back. And I came and visited, and the place blew me away. I mean, the students, the faculty, the humbleness of the place. I fit in here.
Wait, what? You're like, I fell in love with MIT? Fell in love with the culture? Everybody was humble? I mean, that's not, you know, Rafael, that's not the way that MIT is perceived out there, right?
I know. When I was at Stanford, and people, my PhD advisor, people learned that I was considering visiting MIT once I decided. My advisor say, look, we got to go for a talk. And we went and walked around Stanford. And he was just, my mentor was telling me, don't go to MIT. This is a terrible place. They do horrible things to people. I know all that.
This is too funny. This is people understand the competition between the top universities. This is how they talk about each other. Okay. And you were like, me voy anyway.
No, but I just said that I'm going to just see them. I mean, I don't think they meant to tell me those things because of competition. I think the reputation of MIT is one of a bunch of arrogant people that chew people out. And I come here and I meet the people that are famous because of the work they've done. And I know their work and I meet them and I talk to them, but I've never met them in person. And I also, for the first time I experienced, and now things have changed in America, but I'm talking about 40 years ago, I experienced faculty. I met faculty from all over the world. I mean, there were people from Greece and from India and from Turkey and from China and from everywhere. And I just felt not only these people are just humble and pleasant, but this must be the true meritocracy. And I remember leaving after I came for the interview, for the conversation, kicking myself for giving them such a hard time because I didn't want to come, and leaving thinking, boy, now I really wish they make me an offer. And to my extreme delight, they did. Now, what I thought at the time, I was not thinking again as an immigrant, Maria, yet. I was thinking, again, my career in Venezuela, and I want to have my curriculum that I worked at Stanford. Now I'm going to work at MIT teaching for a couple of years. Who on earth will not give me a job back home? I never thought of staying. I never thought that this was what I wanted.
Mm.
But MIT is really, honestly, a very special place. And I've been here for 40 years for that reason.
You know, Rafael, I'm also a professor in the Ivy League. I'm here at Barnard College, part of Columbia University. It's my alma mater. And I happened to have a meeting with one of my students, a Latina, actually, and she says, I'm really feeling burnt out. And she said, every time I come to your class, professor, that's when I feel engaged and reinvigorated. But I'm wondering about this particular culture, especially for kids who are not white and women, right? That there is like this deep competitiveness. It becomes, as she said, my student said, a grind. How do you process that? Because yes, students, they kind of do grind themselves. So how do you figure managing this culture?
Well, it is a very good question. Let me just say two quick observations. When I was a grad student at Stanford, it was hard for me. I didn't speak the language much. I was not prepared. The education that I had in Venezuela, which was good, of course, but it was just behind the times for what I was learning at Stanford. So I did not have a good preparation. I did not understand the language. And it was very, very hard for me. I mean, I remember going to class, I couldn't understand a word the lecturer was saying.
We'd like you to know about abstraction.
So I wrote in my class notes, I wrote everything in Spanish. The sound of what the professor was saying, I wrote it in Spanish. And then in the evening, on my desk, I would try with a dictionary to figure out what the professor was saying in class. So it was very, very, very hard. And the consequence of that is that I felt that I was basically the dumbest person in the whole institution because it was so hard for me.
Yeah.
And when Stanford asked me after I got my PhD to stay, I was extremely surprised because in my idea is that I was not that smart because I just had to work so hard to get my work done. So one normally overcomes those kinds of things. But coming to MIT, I think I took the position that I want to be one more. I don't want to be noticed for my difference. I just want to be noticed for whatever I have that is similar. I remember at the very beginning, some colleagues who would either pretend or not really understand what I was saying, and I don't blame them because my accent is still here and it was much worse 40 years ago. They probably couldn't understand what I was saying, and they showed me that. So, but I ignored that. I just kept going, and I kept going forward. So I guess the point that I'm making is that my attitude was, I'm just going to do the best I can with what I do and not be affected by other people seeing me different. I just speak differently, and that's it.
Mm. So the reality is that Latinos and Latinas in higher education, and I know you know this data, right, that essentially the future in terms of the financial stability of all higher education institutions depends a lot on Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine enrollment. Am I right?
Correct.
So we also at the same time know that Latino and Black students are underrepresented in higher education, that professors and faculty, super, super low numbers, especially in elite schools. So at MIT, in the most recent class, Latino students made up 14% of the incoming class. So how important is this particular issue? Not only a question of representation, because, you know, we're almost 20% of the country, but also in terms of a financial stability plan for the future of higher education and the importance of non-white students?
Well, I think at MIT, the percentage of our undergraduates who are underrepresented minorities are close to 30%. It's 25-30%. And that more or less matches the percentage of underrepresented groups graduating from high school. So in that sense, it is what it is. The real issue to me is that many of them, for a variety of reasons, and many of them could be financial, because at places like MIT, if you don't have the resources, we provide the financial aid you need to be able to study. But once that is done, going to continue to get a PhD, to continue to grad school, I've met many of these students who just have not been able to make that decision because they have to go and work just the same way that I had to go and work after I graduated in that same situation. So that is a concern of mine. I mean, how do we increase the rank of graduate students that come from the underrepresented groups? And that's something that has to be addressed.
Rafael, I believe that you've talked about healing. This is something that you as the president of MIT have actually talked about with your students?
Yes, indeed.
As you strive to hug the world, please try to heal the world too. Our society is like a big, complicated family in the midst of a terrible argument. I believe we can each try to make it better by finding ways to listen to each other with compassion, to focus on achieving our shared objectives, and to try constantly to remind each other of our common humanity.
Okay, President of MIT, wanting to talk to students about healing, why did you feel it was important to talk about this with your students?
Well, when I was a regular professor outside administration, I had 18 or so advisees typically that I kept for 3 years. The first time they came to see me, within the first 5 minutes that we talked, the student would start crying. And the bottom line is that they tell me, everybody here is smarter than me.
Oh my God. I hear this every week, every week.
Well, this student, the first one leaves my office, comes the second one, it's the same thing. So everybody feels everybody else is smarter. And I think my point is that I thought that when I came here years ago, I think MIT was really sometimes treating students and maybe each other with a kind of a sink or swim attitude. And I thought that we are not exactly like that, and it's a misrepresentation of what people were experiencing. So I thought it was important just to connect with the students and for them to understand how well they are, how well they are doing, and how the impression they're getting that is affecting them, you know, how to explain that to them and just simply talk to them. Mm. So it's more the idea of creating a caring community. That was what I wanted to do. And in my 10 years of presidency, every time that I had an opportunity to speak to students and to parents, I would use those kinds of terminology. I mean, caring community, we do try to care for each other. MIT has a motto, it's minds and hands. And we have an initiative years ago that added the word heart. So we are the Mind, Hand, Heart Initiative.
Mm.
So to connect with that caring community, that way of thinking, I think it's important. It was important to me. I think I moved the needle in that direction the last 10 years, and I hope it stays there or even improves in the years to come.
So your replacement is Dr. Sally Kornbluth, only the second woman to be president of MIT. But we know after you're gone, there will not be a Latino or Latina president in the top universities of the United States. There are Latino and Latina presidents, very few, but they are not in the top ranked colleges and universities. So how are you assessing your tenure as you get ready to leave?
Well, the good news and bad news is that I've been so busy that I haven't had time to reflect on my tenure. Hopefully, I'll have some time to do that this coming year. I really wanted very much to be everybody's president here. I didn't want to be identified as the Latino president or the Jewish president or the I didn't want any identification that distinguishes me from others. I just wanted to be one more. Did I succeed? I don't know. Of course, everybody knows that I'm Hispanic. I mean, this is not something that I hide, but it's not an in-your-face kind of thing. I just want to blend with everybody else so that everybody can see me. Yes, I come from a different culture, but I'm just one more. And I thought, and I hope I succeeded, time will tell.
So what is your message for Latinos and Latinas and their pathway to higher education at a time when, you know, there's a lot of people just like, well, it's expensive, I don't know, et cetera. What's your message to them?
Well, my message is really very simple. I mean, if it weren't for education, I wouldn't have had the life that I had. I wouldn't be here. I think Latino, Latinas, Hispanics, Venezuelans, Argentinians, Caribbeans, I mean, they are as smart as everybody else, if not smarter. And I think I just want them to get the message to apply themselves to anything they want to apply themselves, and that things are hard, but they overcome them. Just go at it, find what you want to do and do it. Every one of the ones who are listening to me that are young in college or as young engineers or young economists or whatever, go at it, you will succeed. I believe in all of you. I didn't know that I had to believe in myself, but it just happens. So it happens if you apply yourself. Just go for it.
Rafael Reif, muchas gracias. Thank you so much for speaking with me on Latino USA. Formally, I will address you as the president of MIT. Muchas gracias for this conversation.
Gracias a ti, María. Un placer hablar contigo.
Óyeme, not everybody makes me cry, so you did make that happen.
Well, I'm sorry that I did.
No, I think what the beauty of it, Rafael, was that your dad, ¿cómo se llama?
Jaime.
Tu papá Jaime and my dad Raúl made themselves present during our interview, and that is really the best acknowledgement that we can have for them.
Well, that was very special to me too, María. Thank you for saying so.
With muchas gracias and congratulations and have a great time off.
Muchas gracias.
A ti, a ti, a ti. Rafael Reif will serve as president of MIT through the end of 2022. He plans to take a sabbatical and then return to his beginnings at the Institute, the faculty at the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. This episode was produced by Noor Saadi and edited by Andrea Lopez Cruzado. It was mixed by JJ Carubin. Special thanks to Patricia Zulbaran and Harsha Nahata. The Latino USA team includes Marta Martinez, Daisy Contreras, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., Alejandra Salazar, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Fernanda Santos. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior engineer is Julia Caruso. Our associate engineer is Gabriela Baez. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation fellow is Elizabeth Lowenthal Torres. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, follow us on all of your social media. And remember, no te vayas. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, and Michelle Mercer and Bruce Golden.
One of the top 25 colleges or universities in the United States, MIT.
Well, let me correct this. Not one of the top 25. I would say one of the top five, but that's okay, Maria.
Bueno, yo lo quería decir. Óyeme, I just want to be clear. I was going to say top 10. So gracias. I mean, thank you for the nerdiness of, yes, getting sure that our data is correct.
My numbers. I'm all my fiddly with numbers, Maria. So.